Okay. So, the last stages of all the practice, on the Bodhisattva path, is called the six perfections. So really, the first four of those, this practice of generosity, helping morality, called helping others, patience and perseverance, is the completing of the compassion wing. Having gone through the wisdom wing, having controlled your body and speech, having gone to the next level, having gone to control your mind, got renunciation, you go to the compassion wing, and then you go through these incredible stages. You rid the mind of all the self-cherishing, all the rubbish, all the nonsense, you accomplish bodhicitta, you change self for others, others are more important, and now you go to the final stages of your practice. So in day-to-day life, you're bopping around benefiting sentient beings, and in as well as connecting with them, because you want to benefit them over countless lives, you're going to meet them all again. And then in your meditation, you're perfecting the wisdom wing. And that finally, all of this leads to where you're now learning to get insight into the nature of reality, where you finally cut the root of all the rubbish. So let's talk about that. Cutting the root of all the rubbish. We've been chipping away at all the branches so far. But until we've actually got to the root of the problem, annihilated this primordial misconception known colloquially as ego grasping, technically the term is ignorance, but a very specific ignorance. These definitions are always very precise. This primordial misconception about the very nature of oneself. This is where Buddha diverged from the Hindus. They're the ones who, as the Dalai Lama said, were the ones who began the investigation into the nature of self, this incredible internal work, this amazing Indians before the Buddha, more than 3,000 years ago. And the Buddha went as far as he could go in that system and got to this incredible level of subtlety of the mind and gone beyond all the delusions, incredible being, but he said there's still further to go. So he diverged in his own direction. This is how we have Buddhism. And this is now related to his particular teachings about the very nature of self, his own experiential findings about the nature of self. And this is where all the teachings about so-called emptiness, which of course is the word that utterly throws us. This is all a culmination of the wisdom teachings. So in general, like I've been saying, the whole Buddhist approach is that, you know, our mind is full of these layers and layers and layers and layers of disturbing emotions or of misconceptions, some of which have a powerful emotional component. Attachment, anger, pride, jealousy, all this nonsense. And they're utterly related to this root misconception that posits in the first place, primordially and deeply, we don't ever articulate it, a very powerful sense of a concrete, solid, independent, real, findable, set in stone me. That's the root of the problem. And on the basis of this, you then get attachment to get what that fantasy me wants. The panic attack of aversion and all the dramas when it doesn't get what he wants and all the rest. So far in the wisdom wing, we've completely subdued the grosser levels, the branches, you know, all these voices of ego. We've become an amazing person. We've added compassion to the mix. But now we get to the root of the problem and uproot that. And from that second, from our first second of non-conceptual insight into this absence of this fantasy I, that's what emptiness refers to, from that second, you're climbing out of your samsara into your nirvana. And you cannot fall back after that. You've cut the root. So now you have more work to do to perfect this realization. And then combined with bodhicitta, that's Buddhahood. So we get really thrown by all these concepts, these particular concepts, these words, you know. Emptiness, for example, we get completely lost when we hear that word. But it's like any system, any body of knowledge, it's got its own language. You know, if I start listening to computer science scientists talk, I'm lost. Their words, I can hear their words, their English words, but their words I don't know the definition of, so I'm just utterly confused. So I want to understand, you know, I better learn the language. For intellectual knowledge first. Same here. So like I'm saying, Buddha's saying we've got this wrong, we've got the wrong end of the stick when it comes to how things exist. And there are layers and layers and layers of these misconceptions about how things exist. For example, clinging to things is not changing. We cling to things as permanent. This is a misconception. We think there's no cause and effect. We think we have nothing to do with who we are. Someone else makes us. This is a really ridiculous misconception for the Buddha and brings so much suffering because it's not true. It's not moralistic. It's not, you don't get punished because you don't know these things. It's just believing that $5 is 50, believing that £5 is 50, you're in trouble. You get disappointed every time. So believing that things are permanent when they're impermanent, you're disappointed. Believing that things have an intrinsic nature and they don't, you get really disappointed. Believing things are more delicious than they really are, you get disappointed. Believing things are more ugly than they really are, you get disappointed. All these lies lead us up garden paths and they're the source of our suffering. Big surprise to us. Because we think it's the boyfriend and the weather and the cake. We think it's the thing that we have a misconception of. No, it's the misconception itself. That's Buddha's unique approach. So this root misconception, the mother of the rest, this root misconception, it's so subtle, it's so primordial, it's so instinctive that we can't possibly get rid of it until we've actually gone to a subtler level of mind by having accomplished single-pointed concentration, shamatha. This, you know, this subtle level of focus that these amazing Indians more than 3,000 years ago invented in their pursuit of the nature of self, investigating the nature of self. And Buddha carried on the job and took this technique with him and then went even further than them, he would suggest, and uprooted this primordial misconception. So we're going to start to learn to understand it intellectually, though. Like all this information, we can learn it first intellectually. So Tsongkhapa, our 14th century lineage Lama, he would say the best way to learn about this emptiness, this absence of this fantasy I, is to see it in the framework of the ultimate nature of how we are, is to see it in the framework of conventionally how things exist. The two truths. So essentially what Buddha is saying is, whatever exists, a cup, a toilet, anger, a mind, a person, a table, first you posit it, you then establish it by defining it and then defining it, labeling it and then defining it, and then we all agree that's a table. What's a cup, mummy? A cup is a flat bottom container that holds my tea. You prove that it does it by pouring the tea in it, and you see that it holds the tea, and there's no other contradictory view about that thing. Then we all tick the box, shake hands, agree that's a cup. Now we can proceed to investigate how it exists, because Buddha says we've got it all wrong. We're dumping on top of things layers of things of characteristics they don't have. So we just use the example of the phenomenon called I. We're one of them. We're not a toilet. We're not a cup. We're not a microphone. We're a person. So the word in Buddhism, the word person, self, I, me, myself, being, they're all synonyms. They all agree to this type of phenomenon, one that has a mind. So the words for it are, ultimately, the Buddha would say, there's nothing intrinsic here. There's nothing established here. There's nothing independent in here. There's no independent, intrinsic, self-existent, existing in and of itself, I. We'll go, well, yeah, who cares? Whoever thought there was. And Buddha says that's exactly what we think. We didn't think we thought it because this particular delusion, this particular misconception is so primordial. We don't even give it a name because we just assume it's a truth. Impermanent we can understand. Something being exaggerated by attachment, we can get that. Something being exaggerated by anger, we can get that. But something being the very ontological status itself of a self or a couple or this or that, exaggerating that, that just sounds like weird to us. But this is exactly where all the Buddha's teachings are getting to. This final wisdom of how things exist. He says, that's when we cut the root of the nonsense. That's when we achieve our true nature. And that's when, with added with bodhicitta, is when we become a Buddha and can be perfectly of benefit to others. Finish the rubbish. Gone. Completely. So ultimately, there is no I here. There's no independent thing that's labelled an I that makes me an I. There's no thing in the cup, like an intrinsic cupness. There's no essence, like the Greeks call it, certainly in persons, Greeks would say there's some essence. The Christians would call it a soul. The Hindus would call it an atman, a self. Something intrinsic, independent, separate, that gives us our meaning. In Christian terms, of course, it's given to us by God. Buddha disagrees with all that. It's just an unnecessary embellishment. So the key word is independent. The key word is independent. He says, because of this grasping, this primordial ego grasping, this primordial ignorance deep in the bones of our being, because of this, we believe 1,000,000,000%, and our language expresses it perfectly, that in here, somewhere, there does exist with certainty a real, established, definite, unchanging, independent, findable I. Our language expresses it. It's all nonsense, Buddha says. There is an I, but not independent. So these are the words that are difficult for us. So ultimately you won't find that I. But he said, on the other hand, conventionally, as I said, there is an I that does exist in dependence upon various factors. But our trouble is that the Buddha says, these are called the two truths, conventional and ultimate. Conventional, ultimate, just the terms for them. But right now we have not just two truths, we have two extreme, these are the two views. We have two extreme views. When we hear there is no intrinsic I, there is no I from its own side, we can't help but hear there's no I, nihilism. We chuck the baby out with the bathwater. We fall into the abyss of the great mistake. This is the greatest misconception, the easiest trap to fall into, and it's ridiculous. And then as soon as we hear dependent arising, the shorthand for how things do exist, emptiness is the shorthand for how things, this ultimate nature, and the conventional nature of things, dependent arising, that things exist in dependence upon various factors. As soon as we hear that there is an I that does exist interdependently, we exaggerate that and we go, oh, thank God there is something. Grasp. So here we over-exaggerate the status of things, and here we under-exaggerate. And we kind of go back and forth like drunken sailors between these two extreme views. We do this instinctively, primordially. So we have to unpack all this and unpack and unravel these mistakes, and using logic and at an ever more subtle level in our subtle meditation, annihilate these misconceptions. Get to see the truth, the absence of this fantasy. The emptiness of it, the absence of it. So there's a multitude of methods to do this, a multitude of logical arguments we need to use first intellectually and then more experientially in our meditation to annihilate this misconception, to see the truth, the reality, the fact, the natural fact that there isn't, has never been and could never be that kind of I. This I that we think exists intrinsically, independently, in and of itself. Can't be such a thing. So, of course, these words are meaningless to us because we never thought we clung to that concept anyway. Whoever thought they believed in an intrinsic I, what a joke. But as Buddha says, that's the main mistake we make. So the way to investigate this is to look at how things exist conventionally. And that'll lead us to the understanding of how things don't exist. Which is what we have to realize. So there's different levels of thing exists, different levels of dependent arising, different levels at which things exist in dependence upon various factors. So the one let's look at, it's not the subtlest meaning. This won't get rid of the rubbish yet, but it's a very powerful one, very tasty. We can look at this one. Because of this ego grasping, this primordial ignorance, this maripa, this unknowing of how things actually exist, of how the I exists, because of this ignorance, this ego grasping, this maripa, this unawareness, unknowing. So this ignorance, it's not like ordinary ignorance. Ordinary ignoranceness is, I don't know. Oh, what's that? I don't know. Oh, it's a cup. Well, thank you very much. Now you know the truth. That's easy to fix. If our ignorance were like that, we'd be enlightened in a couple of years. But the ignorance we have got, not only do we not know that there is no intrinsic I, not only do we not know the reality, the Buddha says this is true, he's not made this up, he hasn't created it, he said this is the subtlest level of natural truth, natural law. Not only do we not know that there is no intrinsic I, but we believe in the exact opposite and cling to it mightily and have done so for a long time. And this is the root of all suffering. So it's like double trouble ignorance. So, there's three particular levels of dependent arising that Buddha very particularly argues with, and their views that were prevailing at the time. And the second level, the first one is that things exist. The grossest level of it is that there is a real, permanent, uncaused self. That's sort of what the soul is, you know. Nonsense, Buddha says. The second level is sort of similar but more subtle. Let's just discuss this. We'll kind of conflate these two a bit. That's okay. This ignorance totally causes us to believe that there is in here somewhere among all these bits and pieces, among all these parts, among somewhere we've got body and we have mind, and body itself has many parts and mind itself has many parts. So we utterly, this ignorance causes us to utterly believe that there is in here somewhere, walking hand in hand, as my friend Penday says, with all these other parts, a very special part called I, called me. Like a little mini me in there who's the puppeteer that runs everything. That's a really good way. It's like a little me in there who runs everything, who's like the creator. And philosophically, this is the same view as the creator. And in the same way that Buddha says we don't need creating, it's unnecessary embellishment. We don't need a little mini me to run the show. The parts do fine on their own. So there's many arguments we can use, logical arguments. So let's just look at one. We say, I have a hand. Well, one of these arguments is if we say there's something existing, then, you know, if you say one thing, then you have to point out that one thing. And you say there's another thing, well, you point out that thing. And they need to be separate. If they're two separate phenomena, you need to be able to point them out separately. Or they've got to be different. So a very simple example would be, you know, I say I have a table and a clock. I have a table and a clock. So there are three nouns there, or one pronoun and two nouns, isn't it? I have a table and a clock. Three things. So if that's a true statement, very simply, it's not complicated. If that's a true statement, you have to point out three phenomena. It's very simple. Three phenomena, in this case, that don't depend upon each other. In this case, there's different levels of dependence and separateness. And here's a very simple, obvious example of three really separate, independent phenomena. A clock, there it is, a clock. And there's the table, and there's the eye. So the eye can walk out the door, and the clock is fine. It won't collapse and have a panic attack. The table doesn't need a clock to exist. So there are three independent and separate phenomena. It's really clear. Well, I'll make another statement. I have a nose and a foot. I have a nose and a foot. Three nouns again. I, nose, foot. So without analysis, you look over here, because I made the sounds coming out my mouth, so you look over here, knowing these English words, and you'll see if you can verify what I just said. And without analysis, you will verify I've got a nose and a foot. You'll verify it pretty quickly, you know, a nose and a foot. But we have to analyse it, because implicit in this is a mistake. So we have to do exactly the same as what we did before. If I said three things, we have to point out three things. There's no other way you can have it. So we can point out the foot. There it is. And for it to function, it doesn't need a nose. They're separate phenomena, and they're in fact independent of each other. Separate and independent. Or different. They're different, and they don't depend on each other. That's clear. Foot can cut off, nose is fine. Nose cuts off, foot walks fine. But what about the third one? The person, I. The I. We say it, I. So we have to then point out an I that's very clearly not dependent upon the nose and the foot. Because we believe it, we say it. I have a nose and a foot. When you say, you're such an ugly nose, Rabina, how dare you insult me, I'll say. And you'll say, no, I didn't insult you, I insulted your nose. So basically, without analysis, we believe that there is a separate little me in there. This is a fairly gross mistake, and they say this is not even the subtlest understanding. You've got to go further than this to really annihilate the misconception, annihilate the grasping at the eye. The feeling we have, look at it, I, when Tony leaves me, or when the foot cuts off, or when you get punched in the nose, the pain is called my pain, isn't it? I am in pain, we will say. We'll say that. And it's as if we really do believe, and we do believe, that there is a piece in there that is I, that somehow is kind of the cause of everything. We never analyze it, of course, that's the whole point. And Buddha says we have to analyze it, because she says you won't find one. You won't find a piece that's separate. And this is the proof. The clock is separate from me. The clock for its existence does not depend to its function. To function to tell the time does not depend upon my existence. And for Rabina to function to be Rabina does not depend upon a clock. So we're separate and we're independent. Nothing to do with each other. We're separate. There's two phenomena there. So he is saying, foot is not nose and nose is not foot. They function separately and they're independent of each other. But the eye... So if there is a third component, if there is a third component in here, which we feel and believe, if there is a third component in here called I, who's the owner, like I am of the clock and the table, but the owner of the foot and the hand, which is separate from the foot and the hand, well, just like when the foot gets cut off, the eye will be watching and go, oh, phew, what a relief. It's not me. Poor old foot, look at it. No, it's not like that, is it? I am in pain, we will say. When someone nearly crashes into you, when you nearly fall off a mountain, I nearly fell off a mountain. No, you'd be silly, your body did. No, you didn't insult me, I insulted your nose. And the eye would be watching, feeling sorry for the poor nose being insulted. We know it's not like that. So the point here is this. There is an eye that isn't the nose or the hand or the foot or anything else. But it's not independent, but it's not separate. You can't separate it. Therefore, you can't locate it. You can't point it out. So it's different. The I and the nose, the me and the nose are not the same. They're different, but they're dependent on each other. Because you won't have a nose without an I, without a me. Look at the cup. Oh, this is the wrong kind of cup. No, this cup's good. Look at this cup. It's called a cup. Okay, thermos, cup, whatever. It holds your tea. My cup has a base, doesn't it? Look, my cup has a base. Look, there it is. My cup has a base. Fact. Two nouns. Cup, base. Two nouns. Cup, base. Take the base away. You think, oh, we now got a cup and now we have a base. No, there's no cup. Because a cup depends upon the existence of a base. You can't have a cup without a base. So cup and base are not the same, but they're not different. That's the way to understand. That's the thing to understand. The I, the me, and all the bits and pieces are not the same, but you can't separate them. The I, that's to say, the foot and the hand you can separate, but not the I. This is words. We've got to realize this in meditation. Cut the belief in this belief, it's like an over exaggeration of the status of our I. That's what this ego grasping does, and this is the root of all suffering, Buddha says. Of course, it sounds utterly abstract to us to think that's the root of all suffering. So what a joke. And this is not the subtlest meaning yet. So now take another tack, and let's look at this word emptiness. That utterly throws us. It's just shorthand, okay? It's just this language, it's shorthand. That's referring to the absence of the intrinsic I. That within here, there does not exist an intrinsic I. And we have to discover that absence. So this whole concept of an absence of something, it's pretty abstract. But we get it. If we look at our ordinary language, we understand it. If I get my cup and grab to drink, I go, oh, there's no tea. My cup's empty, I'll say. Oh, look, my cup's empty. Oh. And we know that means of tea. You look at your bank account, you get a shock. Oh, my God, my bank account's empty. You know. Tony leaves me. All I'll notice in the house is the absence of Tony, continuously, won't I? But if you visit me one day and you've never heard of Tony, you won't notice the absence of Tony. And this is the key point about this use of the word emptiness, or even the cup is empty. The only person, this is a really crucial point to get, the only person who will think that your cup is empty of tea is the person who expects tea to be there. You walk into the crockery shop, all the cups are empty, right? But you don't expect them to have tea in it. You go, oh, mummy, all the cups are empty. But you don't expect tea to be in the cup in the crockery shop. So this word, noticing the emptiness of something, the emptiness of tea, emptiness of pounds, emptiness of Tony in my house. That's only experienced by the person who expected or wanted or believed there should have been a Tony, there should be tea, there should be pounds. Same here. We believe that in here somewhere, walking hand in hand with these other parts, there's this very special part called me, mini, like a mini me. We believe it utterly and totally, but of course we never think, ever question it. We just assume it. The me in here, me, you know. We say, I wish I had a, you know, like, you know, when people, I remember Dalai Lama using the example. You know, if you're given the, you know, you're old and fat and wrinkled and about to die, you're given the opportunity to get a nice young body. Oh, you'd love to get a nice young body, wouldn't you? That's an assumption right there. There's an eye in there. Then you can strip the body off and get another one, like a new dress, you know. It's like hilarious. So what are we made of? We're made of body and mind. That's it for the Buddha. There's body and there's mind. They're the components of the phenomenon called I. So finally, this is leading us to the subtlest meaning, that I is merely a name we give out of convenience for these bits and pieces. Cup is a label we give out of convenience to the bits and pieces. But you won't find a special little cupness in there somewhere secretly hiding that makes it a cup. You will not find some special secret essence or soul or me in here that makes it me. Don't need one, Buddha says. So we have to discover that absence. First we have to understand intellectually, and then we can only realize it directly when we've got a single point of concentration. Subtle level of our mind. The gross level's not capable. Conceptual level's not capable. We have to start with the concepts and debate and analyze and argue and look at it all the time at our grosser level. Generally catching ourselves, trying to observe, you know, how this supposed I exists. So you have to discover its absence. That's the meaning of the word emptiness, an absence of something. So this is where it's really crucial to understand that the emptiness does not mean nothingness. This is the major mistake, the major mistake. So a really good example, I'd say, for me a good example, let's say, you know, Tony's got his bank account, and he believes there's £5,000 in there because he plans to come on pilgrimage with me. Maybe he needs about £5,000. Maybe £4,000 for it's about $5,000. He's got to have some spending money, so maybe £5,000. So let's say he needs he's been saving his £5,000. He believes there's £5,000 in his bank. He knows there's £5,000 because he's been saving it. So he looks in the bank account, he goes into his bank, does his password, and he looks on the statement, and in fact, he sees written there, £0. £0. Now, if he asks me to look in the bank, tell me what's in the bank, Rabina, just check, what's in the bank, Rabina? And I'll look at it, I'll say, and I'll see the truth, nothing. I'll see there's no pounds, I'll just tell him the truth, there's no drama for me. I expect nothing, I just tell him the truth. But he, if he looks at that bank account and he's expecting £5,000, believe me, he will see the zero, but he'll have a panic attack. But what he will experience, what he will cognize, is the absence of his precious £5,000, won't he? Like, I'm expecting Tony in the house when I come home from work, because he's been there for the last 40 years, so of course he's going to be there. I will get the shock of my life. Mental breakdown. Complete hysterical when I discover the absence of Tony, when I read that note. In fact, I won't even believe it first. He won't even believe there's no pounds. Not possible, he'll say. Where's my £5,000? Have a panic attack. Now, the really simple point is this. As the Dalai Lama says, when we misunderstand emptiness, and one of the ways to analyze in meditation, it's not enough just to believe Buddha. Oh, there's no intrinsic I there. Okay, there's no intrinsic I. We still believe there is because it's an ancient habit. So we'll keep acting as a ridiculous of attachment and anger, which are the voices of this ego grasping. So it's not enough just to believe it. We've got to prove it to be true. And that is what takes so much time and effort and hard work. First experientially in daily life and then eventually in meditation. So His Holiness says, it's not as if... So one of the approaches is to search for the I, which sounds hilarious. Like, what do you mean search for the I? This is a really very refined analysis we have to do. First you establish what you think this fantasy I is, because it appears to us all the time. Always believing it exists, it rises up in our mind, we have a panic attack, how will this fear... This is the basis. This fear is the main voice of the belief in the fantasy I. That's how come we have fear. Because this supposed I has been attacked or offended, you know. So you have to establish really subtly what they call the object to be negated. You have to establish very subtly exactly what we think the I would be if it did exist. And then we have to search for it. Very precise type of analysis we have to do in meditation. So, as His Holiness says, this is not what emptiness means. You know, this is not what emptiness means. You find all the bits and pieces. So one type of meditation is you'd do a very rigorous analysis and you'd check. You'd take all the parts of the body away. Well, there's the body, there's the atoms, there's the pee-pee, there's the caca, and you imagine putting them out as little piles until there's no physical bits left. That would be a very good analysis. And then you analyse the mind, all the bits of the anger, the love, the compassion, the kindness, the virtue states, the negative ones, all the bits and pieces of the mind, the components of the mind, pile them all out. Now, the fact is, you won't find a piece called I. It's almost as if we will believe once we've taken all the pieces away, we've now just, this little mini-me has now been exposed, you know? We're going to finally find the little mini-me and then kick it out. No, it's not like that. You won't find any component called I. You won't find a component called I. But he says the mistaken understanding of emptiness is if you then chuck out all the bits and say, oh, well, look, I couldn't find an I. There's no I there. No I. No I. That's nihilism. That's not the meaning of emptiness. That's like me looking in the bank and I see zero. That's nihilism. Tony will not see £0. The object he cognizes, the object of my mind, the object I cognize is nihilism, no pounds. The object Tony cognizes is an utterly different cognition, an utterly different phenomenon. He will cognize the absence of his precious, delicious £5,000. So the absence of £5,000 is not the same as no pounds. So the absence of precious inherent rabina, which is what we need to realize, on the basis of not finding an I, we then realize the emptiness of the absence of the intrinsic I. That's the meaning of emptiness. It is not the same as no I. And that's how we think about it. We go, oh, well, everything's empty anyway. It doesn't matter. That's nihilism. It's an utter mistake. It's much more nuanced than that. When we get this right, especially if we understand emptiness in the framework of the two truths, then we don't fall into the abyss of the great mistake. That's how Tsongkhapa says. Of course, it's just words. Everything's words until you learn it. Don't be afraid of words. So people say, oh, I've been thinking about emptiness for 40 years. I can't understand it. Tell me the definition. Oh, I don't know. Well, how can you ever understand if you can't even say the words? I don't understand computers, but I know why, because I haven't learned the words. If I use my noggin, I could learn the words, and I could speak intelligently about computers, but I can't, because I haven't learned it. I haven't learned French. You say French sounds to me, I can get a few words, you know, just gobbledygook, isn't it? Until I've learned the words. So learning the words is a good start. It's intellectual knowledge. It leads you to the experiential. Learning the cake theory leads you to making the cake. Don't ever just think words are boring on their own. They're on their own, they're useless, but if they lead to the experience, they're necessary. Any thoughts or questions about all that? One other little analysis to do. I like this one. If we analyse, you know, I'll make a statement, you know. I'm holding a cup in my right hand. I use the same example. I'm holding a cup in my right hand. Now, let's say I've forgotten how to do it. I've lost my memory, you know. I've had a stroke. I have to practice doing it again. I maybe lost my memory in terms of words. Maybe I had, you know, that tic disease. Some people get and they lose their memory. So I've got to relearn it all. Imagine I've had to relearn it all. Imagine I've had to learn again how to use my hand, where to put the thumb, where to put the pinky, how to do this here, how to hold this, how to learn all the words again. Had to be exhausting. Now, this is analysis of dependent arising. So, let's analyze what bits of Robina are involved in this simple action called holding a cup in her right hand. Let's analyze. There's a bunch of parts, right? Now, at the moment, we believe there is a part called I that kind of is the boss that runs the other parts. That's what we think. But let's do this analysis and you'll see. It's very interesting. So first of all, you'll have to educate me about the body. I'll have to learn to know what is the little finger. Then I'll have to learn to know what the job of the little finger is, and then what the job of the ring finger, and then the job of the thumb, and I've got to practice it. So then if you start to write down a list of all the parts of my body that I have to learn to become familiar with so I can start exercising them to fulfill the job of holding the cup in my right hand, you'll have an awful lot of parts, won't you? You have to be all this one, and the ligaments and the elements, I mean the muscles and the this and the nerves, and the wrist does this and this does this and the elbow does that and the shoulder, all these bits and pieces all working beautifully because I'm trained in it right now. But if I have to learn it again, you'd have to put this long list together and there'd be many, 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 many parts. Do we agree with that, don't we? It's logical. It's scientific. There's many bits and pieces of Robina's body that will be involved that I've got to train myself again, but that will be involved. You have to make that list. You make a list, you'd have a lot of parts, wouldn't you? And each one of those pieces would do its job. Each piece would do its job exactly. In other words, when you start holding the cup with, you know, the pinky won't argue with the thumb. Get away, it's my job. Each bit will have its job. The ligaments do their job, and the muscles do their job, and the nerves do their job. You've got hundreds of parts. And you'd eventually have an exhaustive list, I'd think, an exhaustive list of all the bits and pieces of Robina's body that are involved in the action of holding a cup. That's a fact. That's scientific truth. All those parts. Now, the other part, clearly, is the mind. I mean, if this is a dead body, then don't bother. So if it's a live body, meaning it's got a mind involved, then we have to now look at all the parts of my mind that are involved in this action. Well, there has to be the eye consciousness so I can see. I've got to hear what you're saying. I've got to have ear consciousness. I've got to have tactile consciousness, otherwise I won't be able to feel what's going on. I've got to have all the mental parts, intention, attention, good memory, concentration, mindfulness, you know, discrimination. Many parts of my mind will be involved and many parts of my body. We agree with this, don't we? And you'd have a long list of the parts of the mind and a long list of the parts of the body. These are the parts that make up Robina. We get this. So, they'd all do their bit. They'd all be working together hand in hand, which is what happens now because we do everything instinctively. They'd all be doing their part. Now, the point is this. The point is in breaking down these component parts. Every one of them would do their job. Each would do their job beautifully and we would complete the action. But we feel there's a piece in there that runs it all called I. We believe, you know, the I is the boss. We believe that, like the creator in here, the boss that runs the show. But if we've just analysed all the bits of the body do their job and all the parts of the mind do their job, well, what job is left over for this poor little precious little eye that's been left out? What job is left over? This is a very real question. I'm asking you a question now. What job is left over that the body and the mind aren't doing in the action of holding a cup? What's the job of the eye? It's a real question to you now. I want some suggestions. Are you following my thinking?
Yeah.
What job is left over for the eye?
There isn't one.
Well, we know that. We don't know it, though.
Right, okay.
Because we believe there is. But this is the thing.
It's observing.
What?
No, it's observing.
Observing is a part of the mind. We've covered the mind. It's got to be a thing that is not the body and not the mind. That's the point.
It's wanting it.
That's the mind. Observing the mind. If we want a boss, the boss is intention. If you want a boss, the boss is intention. Because that has to prevail. That's the thought that's in there that does, you know, intention to hold, intention to put the finger, intention to go here, intention to listen, intention to do, intention. But we put this now, the pronoun in front of it. I intend. And we believe, you see, intention. Within the parts of Rabina, there is a piece called intention. Within the parts of Rabina, there is a piece called a thumb. But we believe there's this boss part that is an embellishment. There is a piece that's called I. You don't need one. And you can't find one. The bits do fine on their own. That's exactly the same argument about a creator. The same philosophical view about no self is the same philosophical view about no creator. You don't need a boss. The world doesn't need... This is a shocking concept to Christians and Muslims. This is like the worst sin of pride, to say there's no creator necessary. Buddha would say that. The individual sentient beings all do their job creating their own suffering and their own happiness. That's the meaning of karma. You don't need a boss. Well, there's no boss in here either. But the point is there's no independent, separate eye. The finger is separate, the thumb is separate, the intention is separate. They're all bits that are not the same as each other, but there's no eye that is also there, which we think. It's this embellishment, this extra piece we've created that doesn't exist, that we believe exists. And because it doesn't exist is why we have so much fear, because we try to uphold it all the time. Fear is the main character of the belief in the eye. When that's cut, as Umche says, there is no fear. Fear has gone. Delusions have gone. There's no fear. There's just bliss and clarity and, you know, fearlessness. Fear is a function of believing in the I and then in the function of all the other nonsense that follows. That's why we live in torture, anxiety and panic attacks. When you realize emptiness, there is no fear. There's only joy, bliss, clarity, compassion, kindness, empathy. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. Sounds very delicious. Okay. Time to go to bed on that contemplating. The subtlest meaning, though, this is not even the subtlest meaning, the subtlest one coming on from this one is that finally, I is merely a name we give to the parts. The I is not the parts, and the I is not separate from the parts. It's merely a name we give out of convenience to the parts. Then we'll say, well, at least we've got some parts. No. Because parts is merely a name we impose upon the bits and pieces. Finger is a name we impose upon, we impute upon the parts of finger. Well, I've got a joint. No. Joint is merely a name we impute upon the parts of the joint. Oh, I've got elements. No, elements is merely a name we impute upon the parts of the elements. So you can, this is like a never-ending thing. You will never pin it down to some intrinsic thing. Not possible, Buddha says. Not possible. And don't need it anyway. But the ego-grasping wants to do that. Wants to isolate and pinpoint and point down and sort of set it in stone. Can't. Not possible. Something couldn't exist like that, Buddha says. Not possible. Everything's merely labelled. Everything's dependent arising. This is the entire universe exists. Not just the self. But all phenomena. This is the final wisdom. Combined with bodhicitta, that's the result. Infinite compassion, infinite empathy, infinite joy, infinite wisdom. That's our natural state, Buddha says. It's not belief. This is Buddhist psychology, Buddhist philosophy. So just hold that feeling. Just close your eyes and just focus on that. This potential, this marvelous, this bliss, this clarity, our own potential, kind of taste. No thoughts. Vast. Imagine yourself as vast, clear, blissful, radiant, expansive. No thoughts. Just abide in that. Clear, that clarity. No thoughts. So we just delight in what we've thought about today, all these as many moments as there have been, as many seeds we've planted, as many thoughts there have been. All this has gone in, this thinking, analysing, contemplating, meditating. How marvellous. We keep moving, nourishing these seeds we've already planted, never giving up in the development of this amazing potential. Clearly for our sake, but of course for the sake of others. Because finally, as Lama Yeshe says, in his Mahamudra book, I was going to read you, but I'll do it maybe tomorrow. This very positing and the believing in this separate I, this dualistic view, creates the concept of other. And from this, all the problems come. Dangchob semchob rinpoche ma ke panam ke gyochi ke panyam pa me payang gong ne gong du baba sho gewa di nyuru dag lama sangge drogyo ne drowa chikyang marupa deyi sala gopa sho. So go into retreat mode if you like. No talking, just observe, analyze, think about things, read your book, do your prayers, do your practice, whatever you want. Stay internal. And then when you hit the pillow, think of just seeing your dreams as dreams. And then when you wake up in the morning, be delighted you're still alive. Your petrol tank of morality hasn't run out yet. Mustn't waste this precious life. Hop out of bed. Do some practice. Have breakfast. Come here, listen to some more things, more tools, more food for thought.